Welcome to the Speakeasy Podcast, part of the Cosmic Shambles Network. I'm your host, Bruce Hood, and today we have a mixture of presentations that should provide at least something for everyone. For today's selection, we're going to learn about the hormone cortisol and how it changes in the morning and affects us throughout the day. We'll learn about the need to maintain exercise during pregnancy, and finally, we'll discover there's a relationship between dance and a much sought-after mental state known as flow. So I guess this week, the presentations are all about mind and body. First up, and that's appropriate because he's talking about awakening in the morning, is Robin Law from the University of Westminster. He's going to tell us about how the hormone cortisol influences our wakefulness during the day.
We all have mornings where we wake up a bit confused, perhaps a bit groggy. You might find after breakfast you put the milk back into the cupboard, the cereals back into the fridge. We've all been there. That's what I'm interested in, how the way that you wake up predicts the way your brain functions throughout the day. Specifically, I'm interested in the hormone cortisol. Cortisol is famous for being the stress hormone, but we now know that it does so much more than that. Cortisol is important for the way that your body functions throughout the day. In particular, I'm interested in what's called the cortisol awakening response, or CAR. The CAR is the rapid increase in cortisol levels when you first wake up in the morning. It's triggered by awakening, and we know that it's larger when you wake up in bright light, and it's larger when you're anticipating a busy or challenging day ahead. We also know you see a smaller CAR in people suffering from depression, in clinical burnout, in cancer, in a whole range of different disorders. So the CAR is often used as what's called a biomarker. That's a measure of someone's health status, the presence or absence of a CAR. But what we don't know is why you have a cortisol awakening response to begin with. Why do healthy people have a CAR? That's where my research comes in. I'm interested in the cortisol awakening response in healthy adults, in particular, associations with cognitive function. This is following on from research which has shown that cortisol is associated with cognitive function during the day, so to do with the structure and function of the brain. In my research, I've measured the CAR in the morning, and I've measured speed of cognitive processing, so attention switching tasks, in the morning and afternoon of the same day, using a computer program which measures how quickly you can switch between task demands. I've found that a larger CAR predicts faster performance, so better attention switching on these computer tasks. Also, a big question is, what might be the mechanism which underlies the association between the CAR and cognition? In order to understand that, I've measured what's called neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is the way that your brain adjusts and reorganizes itself in accordance with what you're doing during the day, a basic process underlying learning. Again, I've found a larger CAR in the morning predicts a greater propensity for neuroplasticity in the afternoon of the same day. The implications of this may be very important for the way that we understand brain and body functions on a day-to-day basis, but also potentially important for understanding the whole range of disorders in which you see an abnormal CAR profile. So there are ways that you can change someone's CAR. You can increase the size of someone's CAR using just simple behavioural interventions, like exercise programs, waking in bright light. There are also drug interventions, although the potential for simple behavioural interventions is fantastic because you don't need any sort of drug to do it. So the message of my work is, first, as psychologists, for a long time we've known that sleep is important for the way that your brain functions on a daily basis. And my message is that the way you wake up is important too.
That was Robin Law from the University of Westminster telling us about CAR. I don't know about you, but it's been increasingly difficult to get my CAR to start in the morning. I expect Robin's a bit sick of all the CAR jokes that he must hear when he talks about his research. But anyway, one question I was left with is, how does he measure neuroplasticity that he was talking about? Or is he simply measuring learning efficiency? Clearly, as Robin points out, learning involves neuroplasticity. But is there any additional value when talking about brain changes, rather than simply just talking about learning, if you're not actually measuring the brain? I'd like to know. Okay, next up is a topic I'm biologically incapable of relating to, exercise during pregnancy. This month, the tennis superstar Serena Williams gave birth to her daughter, Alexis Olympia. She was still playing tennis up until she was around 7 months pregnant, which raised a few eyebrows in the press. But as we learn from Amanda De Salvatore, who is studying at the University of Lancaster, more pregnant women should be following Serena's lead without worrying about their health, or indeed the health of their baby.
Very few, only about 10% of pregnant women meet published guidelines for exercise. In addition to discomfort and lack of time, the third most commonly cited barrier and reason women stop or don't exercise during pregnancy is unclear information and uncertainty of safety and risks and benefits. And how are women supposed to learn when popular sources of information are contradictory, confusing, and even inaccurate? For example, the latest edition of the best-selling pregnancy book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, recommends tapering off exercise in the last trimester, which current evidence indicates could actually be detrimental to the fetus. Even the majority of physician recommendations have been shown to correspond to outdated guidelines from way back in 1985. So my research is looking at what women know about exercise during pregnancy, their knowledge, and if that's related to the kinds of information sources they've used to attain this knowledge. I've surveyed about 500 pregnant American women across the U.S. from an online sample. I've assessed women's knowledge in four areas: knowledge of risks and benefits, safety awareness, specific activities, and knowledge of current guidelines. I've also evaluated the sources of information these women have used, such as books, the internet, clinicians, or friends and family. Right now, I'm analyzing the relationship between knowledge level and information source, as well as the effect of sociodemographics on that relationship. And I hope these data will be essential for public health officials and clinicians as they develop programs to provide information to pregnant women, especially in regions with much sociodemographic diversity and many social inequalities. And maybe someday it won't be such a shocking and controversial sight to see pregnant women enjoying themselves in exercise and sport.
That was Amanda De Salvatore from the University of Lancaster. Now, when I said I was biologically incapable of relating to Amanda's talk, I was referring to becoming pregnant, not my inability for exercise. We can all benefit from exercise for our improved health of body and mind. And exercise can influence our minds not simply by raising levels of cortisol, as Robin was talking about, but by creating a mental state of harmony when we are in the zone. Now, one way that people achieve that is through dance. And our last speaker, Asuka Sakuta, is studying dance at the University of Chichester, but in a way that sounds more like brain science than the arts. You know, it's often been said there's a real chasm between the arts and science, the so-called clash between the two worlds. But Asuka reveals how psychology and neuroscience might be one way to build bridges.
You know when you're in that ultra-productive zone and you completely lose track of time, only to realize later that you have done incredible work, almost unconsciously? This in-the-zone state is called flow, which is a term coined by psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. This so-called flow state has become one of the central topics in the field of positive psychology, in which the aim is to enhance our overall quality of life rather than to fix what's haunting our minds. The experience of flow, as some of you may know, is highly enjoyable and rewarding. But apart from its effect on mental gratification, it is also said to enhance our overall productivity and performance level. Flow can occur in a wide variety of scenarios, ranging from work, sports, leisurely activities like playing video games, and even social interactions. In flow, it is thought that a part of the prefrontal cortex, an area in our brains which help us make rational decisions, temporarily deactivates. Brain waves also decline to a slow, steady theta wave, which brings us into a state between wakefulness and sleep. We make spontaneous, lateral connections, and our intuitions seem to become more refined. For example, solutions to difficult problems just seem to pop out of nowhere, or our bodies would take the right action at the right time without us even trying to. Some say that this intuitive state of mind is caused by the awakening of implicit brain functions which are normally overshadowed by our rational thoughts. In human motor control, implicit motor functions often refer to our ability to stand and walk smoothly. But what if there were more that our bodies can do when we shut down our top-down thinking? Researchers in the field of sports psychology have looked into how flow can change the performance level of an athlete, like hitting a target better or running faster. But few have examined the exact changes in an individual's movement qualities. This is where the study of dancing comes in. Curiously, this whole scientific framework coincides with what dance researchers say. They say that when a dancer reaches a flow-like state in their performance, they exhibit an extraordinary quality that can actually be observed by the spectator's eyes. My PhD project focuses on the inhibition of conscious decision-making during flow and its physical manifestation during dance. I have so far set out to find out what sorts of dance-related activities evoke flow and how dancers experience this phenomenon. I'm also looking into how this flow state can manifest on a dancer's body and whether we can identify this manifestation objectively. Keeping in mind that the field of positive psychology aims to find out how we can bring our everyday experience to its full potential, I'll be using my research findings to illustrate a universally applicable paradigm on how flow-inducing dance can benefit not only dancers, but also anyone who is hungry for some physical enlightenment.
That was Asuka Sukuta from the University of Chichester. This concept of flow comes from the American psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Now, he thinks that humans are in a constant state of flux, trying to avoid what he calls entropy. That term entropy comes from Rutherford's notion of physics and refers to the changing state of the universe as it slowly cools down from the Big Bang into a state of disorder. Csikszentmihalyi also argues that humans face the possibility of entropy, and that we expend psychic energy throughout the day to avoid it. Now, when I heard the term psychic energy, my BS woo detectors were triggered, but he's not talking about paranormal energy. He's simply referring to the mental effort. For Csikszentmihalyi, the optimal state of experience for the individual is one in which intentions are not in conflict with each other. In this state of inner harmony, people can freely choose to invest their psychic energy in goals that are congruent with the rest of their intentions. And subjectively, this is felt to be in a state of heightened energy, a state of increased control, the so-called flow experience. And most people find this challenging and enjoyable. You see, every conscious experience lies on a continuum, ranging from boring samefulness at one end to the enjoyable diversity at the center, and finally to anxiety-producing chaos at the further end. It's in the enjoyable middle regions of experience that one's attention is fully effective. This optimal state of involvement with experience, or flow, is in contrast with the extremes of boredom and anxiety. Well, that's it for this week. I hope when you get home tomorrow, your car is rearing to go, you find some time for exercise, whether you're pregnant or not, and you seek out some flow experience, whether through dancing or any other activity. If you enjoyed any of the talks on this podcast, then seek out our speakers on Speakeasy and drop them a line. Invite them to give a talk, or simply leave a comment or a question. I've been your host, Bruce Hood. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Speakeasy Podcast, part of the Cosmic Shambles Network, a digital hub for curious minds. Head to cosmicshambles.com for more podcasts, documentaries, blogs, and more from the likes of Robin Ince, Josie Long, Helen Chersky, and Brian Cox, and many, many more.